turn it over to Brian. Brian's going to give us an overview. It's going to be about 20 minutes. What I'd like to do is, if we have a question in reference to the presentation he's doing, let's ask it. But if it's a more important question, let's hold it till the end of his presentation. And this is scheduled for about 20 minutes. So without further ado, Brian.
All right. I know when we had the public hearing, I talked a little bit about zoning and the evolution of zoning. So I wanted to start out kind of with some things that about the idea of zoning and kind of a history lesson, a real brief history lesson of that. Zoning really evolved out of the idea of nuisance law, which came out of the English colonies, came out of England in the 12th century, actually, the evolution of it. And common law came across it.
And you haven't missed anything. We're just getting started on the first 20 minutes, which is a session on land use.
Oh, thank you.
So common law really came across the Atlantic with the colonists and was kind of adopted by, even when they wrote the Constitution, common law, the principles of common law still apply and actually still apply today in the American legal system. And in terms of nuisance, what nuisance laws really dealt with in early America, as you can see here, was just people obstructing roads, people obstructing waterways, things like that. It eventually evolved to being something where somebody opened a gambling hall, somebody was, running a brothel or just using profanity, apparently. If there weren't express laws on the books, they could use nuisance laws as a way of prosecuting that in early America. But as the Industrial Revolution came forward, a lot of these nuisance laws began getting applied to things like pollution from these now heavy industries that had just kind of evolved in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And consequently, a lot of localities found that nuisance law just wasn't adequate to deal with this. You had industries, filing torts against each other, and sorting it out in the court system was just so difficult that they ended up coming forth with a new form of land use regulation. Zoning ordinances are actually less than 100 years old. They started in, the first one was written in 1916, was written in New York City. And some people say it was a response to this building, actually. So this is a little interesting. This is the Equitable Building in Manhattan. It's the first building that really kind of was built right on the property line, as you can see. It was huge, just a big kind of change from what the type of building projects they were used to seeing in New York City. There's a lot of question about protection of sunlight, what this putting other people in shadow and things like that. So they started talking ideas about step backs. This is actually where step backs came from, and that's why you had why the Empire State Building is stepped back, and why they actually went to kind of the evolution of plaza architecture, which is what you saw with the World Trade Center, where they took a large piece of land and put the large towers set in from the property line to adhere to that. 1926 was Euclid D. Ambler, which was the Supreme Court upheld zoning as acceptable use of the police power. Early zoning, as I mentioned, focused on separating uses, keeping residential away from industrial, and the Euclid D. Ambler case is where the name comes from for this type of zoning, Euclidean zoning, which is the separation of uses. So that's where it comes from. Euclid is the village of Euclid, which is in Ohio. The Ambler was Ambler Real. Where we begin to see 1961 was Jane Jacobs, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. That's, in planning, that's kind of the book that everyone looks up to. You've got to read it if you're a planner. It's just the way it works. But she began, she wrote about, where she grew up and what made the city that she grew up in successful. And the streets that she lived on successful. And she mentioned a lot of things about the fact that there were mixed-use buildings in that area. There were a lot of uses around there. People could walk to and from work. There were always people in the neighborhood watching the streets. And so this brought up a lot of ideas of, suburban sprawl and pushing the residential out of the central business district. You're pushing a lot of the vitality as well. Central business districts that, at 5 p.m. everybody would close up shop and leave, and you'd have this ghost town. In your central city. City of Norfolk was dealing with this, probably still dealing with it to a certain extent, but yeah, if you went downtown Norfolk after 5 p.m. 10 years ago, there was nobody there. The lack of eyes on the street, this is the idea of people that live in their neighborhood keep track of things. They keep eyes on, you know, they're looking at other people's children. If they're messing around, they're out there to scold them or report, you know, it gets back to your parents before you even get home, things like that. And so by separating that out, by putting, you know, kind of separating the uses out, you create a an area where, you know, people are, crime can thrive because nobody's out there watching the street. And so this brings up the current theory, which stresses the putting uses together. One reason is to minimize dependence on the automobile, and also higher density, which tries to halt the kind of leapfrog effect that we see, in where some, you know, people move out into the suburbs chasing, you know, kind of larger plots of land, larger houses, and the commercial and retail follows the customers out there, and you just keep going further and further out into the suburbs and city abandonment where the services already are. So how does the comprehensive plan kind of fit into our idea of zoning? Well, simply put, as we always say, the comprehensive plan is a guide. But to be a little more complex, it's the vision of the community, what they want to see in the future, basically, over a period of time. Communities do different lengths. Obviously, Virginia, we're required to review it every 5 years, but many communities focus on a 25-year time frame, some do 50. There was a movement for a while in planning to look at, you know, 100-year plans, how the community would evolve over three generations. If you read the code, the Code of Virginia, one of the big portions of a comprehensive plan is future capital improvements, where you're going to put your new roads, where you're going to put your new parks and schools, so that as your community grows, you know generally what you're going to have so that you can plan for them and you're not caught in this situation where you have inadequate services. And other items that we talk about a lot, we see demographics in ours. Traffic is makes a big part of this, and also the future land uses and of how your city is going to grow. So this brings up the land use map. It's not required in a comprehensive plan, but it is it's commonly used in most comprehensive plans as a way of showing, you know, kind of graphically what the community intends to locate where, what uses they want in what spots. And, you know, the thing to stress here is the map is also a guide, like the comprehensive plan. It's not a tried and true, you know, it's not set in stone as to this is where things happen. It's kind of a vision for how things will move in the future. And like I pointed out in the past, the map is one of several factors used to evaluate rezoning applications. If you look at the standard of review for a rezoning application, the comprehensive plan designation is one thing, but historic situation is another. What, you know, are there historic resources in the area? What's the current setup of the property? What's the adjacent property like? There are a lot of reasons, a lot of factors that go into evaluating those applications. Some communities tie it very strictly. Like I mentioned, some, you know, the comprehensive plan land use map is it. In Charlottesville, that's not the case. So it really varies from city, you know, locality to locality as to how strong of a link they make between this particular part of their comp plan and how they carry out the day-to-day applications that they get in terms of the land use in their locality.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are you going to touch on, unless there's pertinent to the presentation there, are you going to touch on zoning maps versus land use maps?
Yeah, sure. In fact, I think I'm headed there right now.
Hey.
Yep.
Anticipate the question. Good student.
Yeah. So this brings up the question of the consistency. We talked about zoning ordinances and how the comprehensive plan works. Generally speaking, you know, good planning practice says that you, once you review your comprehensive plan, you then are reviewing your zoning ordinance. You're reviewing all of your ordinances for things that are making sure that they are consistent, that the vision that you're presenting to the public is consistently reflected through all of your ordinances. There's some pros and cons to this, though. The pros are obvious that, you know, it's a very strong link and it's a very easy to follow. If you're in the, you know, a member of the public and you review the comprehensive plan, you see, you know, statements of intent in that, and then you go to the ordinances and you see those same kind of intents carried out, that's a very strong statement that you put forward. The other thing, though, is that, you know, a comprehensive plan on a 25-year timeline, if you're reviewing it every 5 years, you're constantly bumping it forward. So the comprehensive plan is in many cases, not what's actually going on at present. The thing that I usually like to throw out.